My name is Debo Powers, and today's date is October 13th, 2011. I'm interviewing for the first time Ray Hart, and this interview is taking place at 13750 North Fork Road, which is north of Polebridge, Montana. This interview is sponsored by the North Fork Landowners Association and is part of the North Fork History Project. So, Ray, tell us about your early background, where and when you were born, and a little bit about growing up.
Okay, well, I was born in 1929, March 22nd, so I'm 82, in Deaf Smith County, Texas. Deaf Smith was that was his full name. I assume he was deaf. Was a pioneer in the panhandle of Texas. The county seat of Deaf Smith County is Hereford, Texas, which in Boston is pronounced Hereford, as it is in England. Therefore, when I'm in Boston, well, first time I was in Boston, I wanted to find Hereford Street. I asked people, and no one knew what I was talking about, so I wrote it out for them and said, "Oh, you mean Hereford." So, anyway. I was born on a ranch, the Escovada Ranch, about 40 miles northwest of Hereford, Texas, which is famous now for miles and miles of feedlots. It's an industrial beef production. Cows walk in one end of a chute and come out frozen at the other.
Wow.
It also was they had irrigation there even when I was a child, and they grew potatoes and some truck crop. But we were 40 miles from town, and our only means of transport was horse-drawn vehicles, wagons and so on. So we went to town maybe twice a year, something like that. Houses were even sparser than here, I would say, rarely fewer than 8 or 10 miles, because these were large ranches and farms. I went to a one-room school, which was in Rhea, R-H-E-A. There are a lot of classical names there, as there are in Montana. Rhea was the wife of Zeus, as I recall, in Greek mythology. One-room school, one-teacher school, in which there were 6 students who taught all grades. When I was about, 6, we moved off the ranch. My father managed to get a sharecropping deal on a farm, and that was about 20 miles from where I was born, and the nearest town to the place where we moved was called Bovina, Texas, B-O-V-I-N-A, which was Spanish for cow. And it had the reputation of being the largest cattle shipping point in the world at that time, because it was the westernmost outpost of the XIT ranch, which was the largest ranch in the world. It covered what is now about 24 counties and was a Scottish combine. Am I saying too much? I mean, you may not want to know all this stuff. It was a Spanish, Scottish combine that is a consortium that built the state capital in Austin, in exchange for which they were given this huge amount of land, which covered really almost all of the panhandle of Texas, the part that sticks up, looks like a panhandle. That's why it's called a panhandle. Okay. We stayed there until it got time for at least 4 of us to go to high school, whereupon we moved to this metropolis of Bovina, the population of which was under 100, and Dad bought a little place at the edge of town, a farm, and that's where all of us went to high school. This time there were 6 kids in my grade.
So a much bigger school.
A much bigger school. Oh, yes, a much bigger school. Where we had, 4 teachers and a superintendent. An interesting thing is that I think everyone in my class went to college. which was a first for that community. I didn't have a single teacher in high school who was a college graduate. None of them had had any education classes, therefore they knew their subject matters. So you really learned English, you really learned history, you really learned math and so on, and nothing about pedagogy and all of that. These were among the best teachers I ever had. I went on from there to a small college, a Methodist college, in Abilene, Texas, McMurray, now McMurray University, McMurray College then, where I had, in the entire faculty, there was one person who had a PhD, and she was the lousiest teacher there. But these were wonderful, wonderful people, most of them elderly ladies, and in my junior year, they called me in and said, they called me Ray Lee. You use both names in those days.
Right.
But in the South, generally.
That's right.
Ray Lee, we've taught you everything you know. You're wasting your time. You should leave. We want to recommend you go to the University of Texas in Austin, which is what I did. It was a very tough year for me because I had to work out a major. We didn't have majors in McMurray. And so I did, and I overdo everything, so I did a triple major in German, which I'd never had any of, English literature, and philosophy. But by the middle of the semester, I was reading Goethe's Faust and Schiller, and you have to learn. Anyway, so I finished my BA there, then I went to SMU for a master's, and then on to Yale for my doctorate. And that's more than you want to know.
Well, when did the North Fork come in?
When does the North Fork come in? Okay. A little background. My first teaching job was at Drew University in Madison, New Jersey. And one of my early colleagues there was Robert W. Funk, who was even then a rising scholar. We became fast friends. And he began telling me stories about Montana. He was himself a Hoosier from Indiana. But his roommate was from the town in Butler, Indiana. The college they attended, Butler University, was in Butler, Indiana. But his roommate was from Kalispell, Montana. And at the end of Bob Funk's second year, the college doctor called him in and said, "Mr. Funk, you're working yourself to death. You've got to take the summer off or you're going to ruin your health." "I can't take the summer off," he said. "I have to work to make money to come back to school." The doctor said, "Okay, I told you. You're going to regret it." So he went home and told his roommate, and his roommate said, "Well, hell, come spend the summer with me. We'll just live off the land." So they came out and hiked in the park all summer and just lived off berries and fishing and animals and so on and so on. This was in the 40s. Mm-hmm. So he fell in love with the place. And after he had finished his graduate work, he kept coming to the North Fork. He said he loved the park, but he loved the North Fork. And the old doc who owned the schoolhouse place, everyone will know where that is, that just north of Ford Station. Mm-hmm. Right. The old doc was from Texas, South Texas, and he was getting very old and liked Bob and offered to sell him the cabin. So Bob talked with me about it, and I thought he was a damn fool, you know, because this guy wanted $2,000 for a log cabin and 3 acres of land. And I said, "Bob, how long will that take to pay out?" And he said, "What do you mean, pay out?" "Well, what can you make off of it?" And he said, "Nothing." And I thought he was a damn fool. At all events, he had sense enough to buy it. And then we met in 57 at Drew. By 1963, I left Drew and went to Vanderbilt University in Nashville, where Bob had received his PhD. And once I got there, I managed to open a job for Bob, so then Bob moved to Vanderbilt. All right, so I'm coming to the point. In 1965, Bob was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship, which is probably the most prestigious fellowship in the world, and he was going to spend it at Tübingen, Germany. And he said, why don't you and Fern and the kids go up and stay in our cabin in the summer of 65? So I talked to Fern, and the boys were wild, you know, to go west. So we did. And we came up. Bob had, in his time in Montana prior to that time, he had pastored a little Christian, First Christian Church in Polson, Montana, and developed a lot of friends there. And one of them owned the John Deere outfit in Polson. So he said, you just get yourself to Polson, and I'm sorry I can't call his name now, it will come to me, his friend, just dropped everything. And he and his wife got in a pickup with their kids and then drove us up to Bob's cabin. Well, it's a good thing he did, because I couldn't have gotten anything going. The generator or the water system, I mean, you had to prime the hand pump and all that stuff. And also introduced us to the dearest people who have ever been on the North Fork, Lloyd and Ruth Saunderson, who lived down in the old Top Hat House.
Oh.
You know,
yeah.
At that time. Well, I'll say more about them later on. So, all right, that's how we got to the North Fork. And we got bitten by this. I should say that I wanted to come because I'd never fly fished. So Bob called me about 4 days before they were leaving for Germany, and he said, have you caught any fish? And I said, no, I don't know how to fly fish, you know. I just had, you know, a cane pole and worms and stuff, and you don't do that on the North Fork. So I said, all right, that does it. I'm coming out. I got to show you how to fish. So he said, I'll be out tomorrow, assuming I can get a plane reservation. All right. Now, he had called, this is how different things are now, he had called the Ford Ranger Station, and the ranger came up and got me and took me down, and we talked on the old crank phone. It was a DC line. And so he called back in an hour or two, and the ranger brought the message that I was to meet him in Great Falls tomorrow afternoon, the next day, about 6 o'clock. So I drove down to Lloyd's, and I said, this is how dumb I was. I said, Lloyd, where is Great Falls? And he said, why do you need to know? And I said, well, Bob Funk's coming in at 6 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, and I've got to meet him. And I said, how long will it take? And he said, oh, I think about an hour and 10 minutes. So I said, fine. He said, be here at 4:30 or something like that. So I drove down, and Lloyd had rolled out his plane, and we got in the plane and
plane.
Flew to Great Falls, and Bob's plane was late. We got back, it was dark, and I won't go into that. At all events,
but you
Bob,
flew him up here.
He came out, he couldn't stand it.
Yeah.
He couldn't stand to, he had never missed a summer, and he never did after that until he moved to California. Well, at all events, that's how I knew about the North Fork. Now, I should say about, and I will just interlard some comments here, because I know one of the questions is, what has changed and all that in the time that I've been here. So having come in 65, let's see, 65, that's 30, 35 plus 11 is 47, 46, 47 years I've been up here.
Yeah.
Okay. I would say probably the most palpable change is that this was a much, much smaller place in terms of the number of people. Year-round people probably weren't more than 8 or 10, at least from Pole Bridge north to the border. And it was, if I can introduce a couple of technical terms from sociology, Weber, a great 19th century German sociologist, really the father of the field, distinguished between a Gesellschaft and a Gemeinschaft. That means he distinguished between a society and a community. And a community is sort of like a family, you know. And a society is where people are discriminated by what they do and their profession and this, that, and the other. And you get a society together because you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, that kind of thing. But it's not a real community. Well, this was a real community, and in no sense a society. When you went to meetings at the hall, what was then called the North Fork Improvement Association. Actually, the hall hadn't been built at that time. We'd meet in each other's homes. We often met in the McFarland Ranch headquarters over in the park, and sometime up at Helen Foreman's. We didn't meet in the homesteader cabins because they weren't big enough to house you. At all events, when you would go to the hall for all kinds of functions, I was, you know, from the first summer, I was interested in trying to get a place up here. I never saw a for sale sign for the first 20 years I was up here. And people didn't tell you that there was land for sale. Why? They were looking you over. Yeah. They were looking you over because they weren't going to let anybody in. And so they're not going to tell anyone there's land available up here until they decide whether they want you up here or not. Uh-huh. Now, in the midst of all of this, of course, there have been forever and from the beginning feuds, constant feuds. The law of a society now, and people bring their own histories, and it takes a long time for people to get acquainted and so on and so on. But in those days, it really was a closed community. Yeah, come on, you could come up here. They didn't object to tourists, they just didn't want them to stay. They didn't want them living up here. So, let's see. The second, early in 67, I had a letter from Lloyd Saunderson telling me that there was a cabin and a piece of land that I might be able to buy worth the money. He's the first one who had ever, and he's the one who mattered the most because he was the patriarch up here. And I said, well, how's this land come on the market? Well, he said, there's a good guy and a bad guy that own it. Buzz is the bad guy, and of course he's from California. And what was the other guy's name? The good guy's name. I remember the bad guy's name. The good guy's name was Hans Andersen, believe it or not. He's not the one who wrote the children's story, but Hans Andersen. He was a really good guy. He was a retired army guy, and he loved his horses, so he had corrals and a barn here and so on the place. The barn I changed into Umi Cabin eventually. Well, the story of how it became available is the good guy didn't hunt, but the bad guy hunted, and he broke all the laws. He brought, in the summer of 66, he brought a gang of his California buddies, and they got all liquored up, and they chased a herd of elk up near the border and simply slaughtered them. They didn't skin them, they didn't take the horns, the racks, they didn't eat them or anything. They just left them to die. Well, that was an unspeakable breach of the code up here. I mean, I never saw a game warden up here for 20 or 30 years. But you didn't... I think the truth is that the old homesteaders, when they get hungry in the winter, they'd go out and shoot a deer, and no one ever said anything. But to slaughter a herd of elk and just leave them... So Lloyd organized a posse and didn't have any trouble getting them together. And they chased Buzz and his buddies to the Idaho border. They didn't catch them. But then Lloyd wrote him a letter and said, Buzz, if you ever show your ugly face on the North Fork again, you're a dead man. You don't believe it, you try it. So that's when he said, I think you can buy that land for money. So I couldn't afford to do it myself. So Bob and I went in together and bought this place. Then ultimately I bought Bob out. Mm-hmm. So that's more than you want to know.
That's great.
About
what a story.
How I got up here. And I don't think I've missed a summer since.
Mm-hmm. So when you first lived up here, you lived in the homestead cabin.
The homestead cabin, yeah. That was all there was. Well, there was what they called a bunkhouse. It was an ice room and a wood storage room and a general catch-all place next to it. No, this place was the southern quarter. It was the south 80 of a half section. The homesteaders were Harry and Lena Holcomb, who have the greenhouse just north of me. The next one up from Barnes's on the right. In Barnes's place, there was an old, as we call them, the widow woman. What was her name? I'm sure Larry Wilson can tell you. At all events, Harry and Lena were wonderful people, and their daughter, Esther, she was sparking Walt Hammer. We'll come back to Walt Hammer. And Harry did not like Walt Hammer. He joined a large company. Harry was a German expat. We'll talk about him later. Harry did not like Walt Hammer, but he did like Ralph Day a lot. So he said to Esther, "Now, it's your business. You pick your husband. But if you pick Ralph, I'll give you the South 80. So she was smart.
So she was smart and did that.
She got the South 80. And we bought 40 of that.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
So that little homestead cabin was where they lived.
That's where they lived.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they built it. And I think it was 1914. So in 3 years, it would have been 100 before we moved it up here. Yeah. And Harry and Lena farmed the meadows, and as did Ralph and Esther this year. And that's how they made a living somehow or other. And I know you'll be interested in roads and that sort of thing, and I'll come back to that when we talk about about Harry.
You knew a lot of the homesteaders up here then.
I knew all of them who were alive at that time. Uh-huh. I believe I did. Uh-huh. I knew the ones on the south end less well than up here. Uh-huh. We might just, if you want to transition to that.
Yeah.
I think that's
I would like to hear about the homesteaders.
Well, mind you, it was difficult to get around up here. I thought we would never get up here. It took us 3 hours from Columbia Falls to get to Ford Station. And that was with a guy leading us. It was a one-way road.
And that
road.
Was in the 60s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, this was in 65.
Uh-huh.
It was a one-way road. And of course they were logging the piss out of this country up here. So there, you had to be prepared to meet a logging truck every 20 minutes or so. They just come in, they never slowed down. Well, it's a one-lane road, so when you saw one of these guys coming, you got in reverse wherever you were going, uphill or downhill, and you backed until there was a little place side of the road you'd get off so that they could barrel on past you. So there wasn't a lot of going up and down the North Fork Road. In fact, the mail carrier in those days, Fred Boss, was a wonderful man, and the store, Ted Ross was the owner of the store, the Merck. And unlike today, most people bought their groceries at the Merck because you're going to town with such an ordeal. And of course, you couldn't carry a lot of stuff, but you'd just give Ted a list. And then next time he went to town, he'd buy you groceries, just charge you what he paid for them. And Fred would take, I mean, we didn't know anything about this road. We sent probably an average of 2 tires once a week down with the mailman to get them fixed. And he'd get them fixed, and you just pay him what it costs and so on. You know. So, why don't we just start up north, and I'll try to work south.
Okay.
About the homesteaders. And I guess there was no one at the border at the time. Well, George, the guy who writes for the Hungry or not, yeah, the Interlake, George, what's his name? He wasn't a homesteader, was an old-timer. Let's see, I guess the first people I'll say something about south of the border would be Helen Foreman. And I don't recall her husband's name. He was an attorney. They were from Illinois. But she was sort of the matriarch of the North Fork. And Richard Hiltner is either related to her or is the executor of the Foreman estate, I think. I think that's the connection. But Helen was a grand lady. She and Fern, my wife, became very good friends because Fern was working in the League of Women Voters here once we moved here and got very active in the State League of Women Voters. And Helen had been national president of the League of Women Voters. They were staunch Republicans. And she was, in fact, I think, chair of the Republican National Committee 1 year. They were very sophisticated people, but they were also really down home up here. And as I think I may have indicated, we held some of the North Fork Improvement Association meetings in their home, and they had a big barn, which we also use for square dances and so on. I haven't been up there in years, so I hope that the barn and so on is still intact. Then in that area, not a homesteader, I think, but a wonderful old-timer was George Walters. Mm-hmm. He was dean of the college at McAllister in Wisconsin, if I've got my school straight. And he and his wife were wonderful people. Their son, David, grew up here, and he became head of the Montana Historical Society. Mm-hmm. And his daughter, Emily, still has a part of the place, and her siblings. I guess the next home, among these, the first real homesteader south that I knew was Ralph Thayer on Trail Creek. Mm-hmm. And was a gentle soul, bachelor his entire life. Worked for the Forest Service. I forget his technical title, but one of the things he did was the surveying. He did all the surveying on the North Fork and did it badly. He did it as well as you could do with chains and, that chains and whatever else they use. And for example, on my place, I went by his survey when I developed my spring box. And according to his survey, it was on my land. But then when the Forest Service came through with their geophysical instruments and helicopters and all the positioning that, where it's infallible, or they claim it is, it turned out that I was about 150 feet over in the Forest Service land. But when I found that out, I went to the head ranger and said, "You know about Ralph Thayer's surveying?" He smiled and said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, I'm another victim of it." Anyway, they gave me a permit. Ralph was, in addition to surveying, he was, I think they call it, a timber cruiser for the whole North Fork. Mm. And he did it on bear paws, snowshoes. And I, at the auction, I bought his bear paws.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. And so I have Ralph's bear paws. I was terribly interested in that cabin of his on Trail Creek, and I asked him about it once, and he said, I guess I shouldn't say this. He said he was going to sell it to someone local. You know, I wasn't local.
Oh.
I hadn't been here, 50 years. and that person has done a lot of subdividing, which I don't like. But anyway, as you know, Nancy and John Hubble mm-hmm. have that place now. Okay, working south, the next couple would be Frank and Ella Wirtz. Mm-hmm. And they had, like most couples, they had a half section, because the husband, or one of them could file for one quarter and the other one could file for another. You had to live on them X amount of time and all that stuff. So it made sense to try to get as much land as you could, which would be 320 acres. Well, Frank was said to be a full-blooded Cherokee, and evidently had a mean streak in him, which Ella discerned early on. So on her quarter section, she got all the water rights to the whole half section. And when Frank got mean, this gives new meaning to cutting somebody's water off. She would cut his water off until he straightened up. That was her way to handle spouse abuse. That place, they were wonderful people. They were wonderful people. One winter he got bored, so he undertook to hew all the logs inside this two-story house. And to do that and get the corners trued up, he must have been really bored, you know. And he must have made a terrible mess. I can see why his wife might have gotten a little cyst with him. That place was bought by the Jokers, J-O-K-E-R-S-T, Jim, and I think his spouse's name is going to escape me, although she and her family were from Amarillo, Texas, where Fern is from, and Fern and her dad knew this woman, girl, and her dad very well. Her dad was a tycoon who owned a chain of international hotels. Jim was an artist, a painter, and a wildlife biologist. They were wonderful neighbors. And I also wanted that place. But at that time, my boys, Morgan and Bracken, were getting ready to go to college, and I had to decide between sending them to college or buying some more land, and it's a good thing I didn't buy it. Except it would have been a great thing to have to hold on to and sell, as was proved by the people who bought it from the Jokers, namely Dick and Barbara Lawrence, who subsequently split, but their daughters, Tina and Karen, and what's the boy's name? It's not going to come to me. All the kids are now in Montana, though Barbara and Dick owned a chain of camera and photo and hi-fi equipment stores from Jackson Hole to Seattle. And Barbara has kept those. Dick has gone, I think he did construction after he left. But the Barbara was German, and so she kept milk cows, and they had a big garden, and they had chickens. So we had milk and butter and eggs and fresh chickens as long as they were around. Of course, we bought them. They also had horses. Okay, moving south. Okay. Wurtz's. Then there would be the Raiders. I forget their given names. They were Dutch. And people would know it now because John and Pat Elliott bought their place. And it was the show place up here. The woman was a Mrs. Raider, was a wonderful gardener, and she's responsible for all those wonderful flowers in the garden and on the property. John and Pat owned a wood stove store in Columbia Falls. John was a professional surveyor and did surveying after Ralph quit. Well, and John had equipment to, it was right. That is to say, it was within 100 yards of being right, something like that. I mean, it was, Ralph was within 100 yards of being right, but not exact. So the Raiders, I knew them, but I met them only after they moved to Missoula and lived in a double wide. I didn't know them when they went there up here. The Elliots had the place when I bought here. There was another couple from Great Falls down on the river, but not, they were not homesteaders. I'm trying to think. Stone Street, Trudy and John Stone Street had the place on the left immediately north of me. And Trudy Stone Street was the sister of Hazel Lawson, Hazen and Ruth Lawson had the Square Peg Ranch down by Pole Ridge, which is owned by John Fredericks now. And Trudy's sister, I mean Hazen and Ruth, Ruth's sister was Trudy Stone Street. So, you know, Now, I'm uncertain whether Hazen was a homesteader or not. Hazen Lawson, who had the Square Peg Ranch. I'm just not sure about that, but they were certainly wonderful people. Hazen was a small town school superintendent in lots of places in northwestern Montana. Eureka and Libby and Sunburst and places like that. Okay, I'm moving south now. And of course, across from Stone Streets was Harry and Lena Holcomb, who were our nearest neighbors, homesteaders. And I'll just, Harry always won the Brew Ribbon for his rutabagas, the biggest rutabaga, at the Flathead County Fair. And one year, it was so big, he put it in one number two wash tub and another wash tub on top of it and tied the bales together. And that's how I got it down to the fair. They were hard scrabble homesteaders. A story or two about them. As you know, that house, it's got a front room and then a kitchen and in between and the back and the bedroom at the back. One night, Harry heard a ruckus in the front room, the living room, sitting room, and grabbed a flashlight and his shotgun and opened the door in the living room, and there was a grizzly up on his hind legs like that. So he shut the door and went back in the bedroom. Then he heard him break through into the kitchen, throwing pans and raising hell. Then he knocked down the door to the bedroom.
Oh.
And Harry was standing there with a shotgun. And he reared up again, fortunately, and shot him in the heart and dropped the grizzly at the foot of their bed. He was just sitting up in bed with his shotgun.
That's a good story.
I asked him how, because when he homesteaded here, there was no road. I don't understand this, because I don't know how people got up to Moose City, which, you know, was a thriving population. At least the road was not usable in the winter. Maybe that's the way to put it. But I asked him, how do you live up here in the winter? He said, oh, well, you make two trips to the store. You wait till the North freezes over, and you hitch up a team, and you put spikes going down out of the horseshoes. Of course, you got spikes to go up to nail in the shoes, then you put some down. And you have a big sled, or sleigh, and on a winter day, it'd take all day to get to the store. And they'd spend the night with Bill Adair, or whoever was running the store at the time. Adair had the saloon, and I think he had the store at that time. And you'd go down and you'd get barrels of flour and kegs of salt and pepper and sides of cured hams if you hadn't raised enough hogs. And you'd get your, you know, all your staples. And you'd spend a day or two down there, and they'd play cards and drink whiskey, I suppose. And then they'd come back up, and in the winter, you'd go out and saw big blocks of ice out, take your ice tongs and bring them in, and everyone had a meat room. We did here. He had built one for, or Ralph built one for Esther here. You have these big thick walls filled with sawdust, and then you just set these blocks of ice, and then you hang your deer and elk and beeves, whatever you're going to eat for the winter. Told you about the rutabagas, told you about the bear, told you about how they got to town. I think that's probably enough on Harry and Lena. I don't know what their religion was. Their kids and grandkids all became Mormons. I don't think Harry and Lena were Mormons. But anyway, Harry was kind of crazy about his property. For example, this widow woman I referred to, living where Barnes now is, uh-huh. She had a little cabin over there, and she had it because he had let her just build a cabin on his land. But then, and she had a cow, which she was absolutely dependent on for milk, and she had chickens. Mm-hmm. So he took pity on her and just gave her a 10-acre slice between his place and Ralph and Esther's place. And that's why Doug's place is there. There was no zoning, no one ever thought about anything like that. Okay. His boy Bud never had any interest in the North Fork, so he didn't leave him any land. But an interesting thing, much later, he decided he wanted to be up here after all. When Ralph was on his deathbed, and I don't know if I should tell this or not, but I think it'll tell you about someone that I miss that are not homesteaders but wonderful people, Baird and Esther Cressman, uh-huh. who live up in the area where Larry lives, and near the Foremans. They were very close friends, because the Crispins were also from Illinois, and they knew the Foremans back there. Baird was a big fertilizer dealer in Illinois, in the farm country. Anyway, when Ralph was what came to be his deathbed, they were close friends of Ralph and Esther Day too. So Ralph went in to see Baird. Actually, Esther told me this story. Baird went in to see him and asked Bud Holcomb if there was anything he could do for him, anything at all. Just say it. And Ralph said, "Well, I'm ashamed to say it, Baird, but I don't have money to pay this hospital bill, and we don't have enough money to bury me. So if you could loan me some money, I'd appreciate it." Baird said, "Anything you want." "All right, sure." And he said, "Well, since I'm probably not going to live anyway," he said, "the only way I'll take it, absolutely the only way, is if you'll let me sign over the South 40 to you." And Baird said, "I don't want you to lend. Besides, that's too much for what you've asked me to lend you. I mean, it's not enough." And he said, "I won't take any more. And I won't take it if you won't let me sign it over." So he signed it over. Well, Baird didn't want it. So he put it up for sale, and it's been through several hands. And Bud bought it, actually. The guy who didn't want to be up here.
Right.
When his brother-in-law died and came on the market, he bought it. Well, I mean, that's the kind of thing that happens up here all the time.
Uh-huh.
Well, let's see, moving south, of course, Ford Station. Ross Wilson, who had owned the Kentler Ranch up north, that had been disposed of. I don't know where it went. I know that Larry bought some of it back. Ross and what was his wife's name? I'm sorry, I'm having trouble with spouses' names here. Wasn't Mary. Anyway, they bought, well, I think it may be a quarter. It's what Holy Cross has now.
Uh-huh.
And they lived in a double wide down there. I'm just working south. I'm sure Ross was he had been county sheriff, I may have said that. I don't think there's anything else about them. Working south. Lloyd and Ruth were living in the old Top Hat, so-called Top Hat building. That was a sign off of a joint, a dive in Missoula, and someone got it up here and put it on a house. It wasn't on there, of course, but Lloyd and Ruth. But Lloyd and Ruth finally got enough together to build their big A-frame down on the river. Saunderson's Meadow, which is now Forest Service. Forest Service bought that. I should say that Barbara Lawrence, you know, held onto that property and finally sold it to the Forest Service. So that whole half went to the Forest Service. And Lloyd and Ruth, they built the A-frame, and the community then got together to build him a barn, and actually built it in 2 days. And that was a great event. And of course they were committed to getting a place for the hall. So we had another barn raising, so to speak, for the hall. But it was not until after Lloyd died of lupus. He had terrible skin disease. And it was only after he died that the association voted to name it the Saunderson Hall. Now, they were a wonderful couple. He was a logger. And his first sawmill, I expect Bert Edwards has stories like this too. He had a little jackleg sawmill that he was running off. He'd just jack up his Model A and put a belt on the wheel that would turn the sawmill. And he was, you know, he was hand feeding logs through there, sawing lumber and so on. Well, I didn't know him at the time, but Bill Gallagher in Missoula owned Caterpillar for the whole state of Montana. He was a marvelous man and very generous man. He owned the Kalispell Caterpillar dealer too. Of course he did. There, one in Montana. He's one of the wealthiest men in Montana. Lloyd went in to talk to him about something, and he said, "You got a sawmill up there?" He said, "Can I come up and see it?" And he did. He said, "Lloyd, I know your reputation. You're a damn fool. Why don't you have a real sawmill up here?" And we said, "Lord, I couldn't pay for it." And Gallagher said, "I'll back you. You just come down, buy what you want, and pay it off." So he did. So when I came up here, Lloyd had a sawmill in Canada, just across the river. And no, it was this side of the river, but he was hauling logs out of Canada. That's how different it was. You know, the border was open.
Right.
In fact, once a year, we always drove up to Fernie. And I really miss that. That was great, great fun. So he had a sawmill up there, and then he had subsequently had another one. He kept that one going, but he had another one back here on the back Teepee Lake Road. And everybody up here knew that at 4:30 in the morning, you're always welcome for breakfast at the Saunderson's Mills, and Ruth cooked. And they were fabulous, you know. She loved to bake.
At 4:30 you know. In the morning?
Yeah, that's when they ate. You can imagine when she started cooking. You know, her biscuits, her flapjacks, her bread, she would use nothing but either Montana hard wheat, and when she couldn't get that, she'd drive to Canada to buy hard wheat up there, because she was real stick. They're Scandinavians, Norwegian. They didn't have an accent, but anyway. And you'd get up there and they would be hot cakes and ham and bacon and steak and eggs and hash browns and syrup and jellies and all that sort of stuff. And you never paid anything. You know, just if you were up moving around in the dark and wanted to eat a real breakfast, you always stopped by the Saundersons. They were like that with everybody. And he's a guy who'd stop his sawmill and go fix your power plant or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. He was the Mike Eddy, except that he'd never take any money. You know, uh-huh. They were the most loved people up here, I think. And they did everything. I mean, I was such a greenhorn. I'd never seen a pine tree. It's hardly a tree at all. So anyway, so we're down to Saunderson's. And let's see, I guess the next would be Frank and Ethel Newton down on the river. Frank had worked in the Forest Service, had worked in the park. I don't know Ethel's background, but they had a homestead down there, and I think they homesteaded in 1910. It may be the earliest one that I know about, or maybe Holcomb's were earlier. But Frank and Ethel got married they didn't have a cabin yet, they had a tent. They got married, got on their horses right after the ceremony, and rode across the river and spent 2 weeks in the park camping on their honeymoon in the park. Then they, they took their horses into the park. And then they rode them back and slowly, you know, from the tent began building their house on the North Shore. Ralph built his own boat, which was a Mackenzie River keel boat, you know, those kind of like that. Uh-huh. That's the only thing he'd get in the river on. Uh-huh. He thought canoes were silly, and rafts in those days, never get in the North Fork River in something that you can't control yourself. One person controlling it, because two people, nobody obeys orders up here. So, let's see. Bert Edwards, that was the old man's name, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Thelma.
Thelma.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I bought my first 2x4s from Bert. 2x4x10s for a nickel apiece. I think I bought 300 of them. I still got a few of them. They were strong, of course. But can you imagine a nickel apiece for a 10-foot 2x4 now,
yeah,
which is a genuine 2x4s, wasn't plain. Then, of course, Tom was his son, mm-hmm, right? Tom I knew when he was manager of WBC in Whitefish.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Oh, the old man on the right, just before you cross Red Meadow Creek going south. Why am I blanking on his name? Oh, and I've forgotten Ramones.
Uh-huh.
What was her dad's name, Mr. Huck? The association used to meet up there on Sunday afternoons for skeet shoots and things that took outdoors. We'd fish fries and outdoor dinner on the ground, sort of, mm-hmm, picnics up there. Helen Huck, it was Mr. Yes, her father's name was Huck. And I think the mailbox may still say Huck on it, uh-huh, as you go down. But that, I got to that by forgetting the name of the family that lived there. Oh, it's at the end of the Chimino property and just across the road by Red Meadow. I'll try to think to ask Morgan, and maybe you can write it down and edit. He has a nephew who still comes up here. A grandson who still comes up here. South of Red Meadow. I don't think I knew any homesteaders in that area. And as you come to the outskirts of Polebridge, I've already said a little bit about Hazen and Ruth Lawson. And the other one, of course, would be Frank Newton. Frank Evans, who I think was not a homesteader, but he was up here as long as a lot of the homesteaders. He knew all of them, absolutely all of them. And I might say parenthetically, really the most precious thing you could get would be a recording that Bob Funk did one night. We did it at the hall. It was after the hall was built. And he took several bottles of Jim Beam down. And we got all of the then living homestead men together. And after they were sufficiently liquored up, they talked for maybe 2 or 3 hours.
Wow.
And Bob recorded that. And he is dead now, but his wife has it, and I'm going to see if I can get it, because we ought to get that transcribed, you know, on a tape or digitally or however this works, probably digital now, and get a typescript made of that. Because this were the homesteaders themselves talking about the early days. And you can probably tell from that how much of this I've made up, you know, or the way I remember. I told it the way I remember it.
Yeah.
But that needs to be done. I should say also about Bob and Mickey Funk, how heavily they were involved in this community. Bob was then at the University of Montana. I came to the University of Montana in 1969. I had a place up here. Both Bob and I had places up here before we both went to the University of Montana in Missoula. where I brought there first as a consultant from Vanderbilt to advise them, and then I advised them, and the president called me up and said, "You're so damn smart, why don't you just come do it?" And I said, "Can I bring a colleague and two or three others?" And he said, "I was just asking you." And I said, "Yeah, I'm telling you my price." Anyway, we came.
Bob, so you all got jobs because of that?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. That's great.
Yeah, I got one senior person and two junior persons, and I had a commitment for a PhD program and so on, which was damn foolishness, because the state couldn't deliver on all that. But that's after I got to be a Montanan and understood how poor the state is. Mm-hmm. It's a great place to live. It's a hard place to make a living. Anyway, Funk up here, he fought very long and hard to get Wild River status for this river. And he was put on a prestigious commission. I'm sorry I'm not going to come up with his name. A famous ecologist, environmentalist, who was at the university and then went on to head some big regional thing about the use of rivers and so on. Anyway, they didn't get wild river status, but they did get wild and scenic. And that would never have happened without Bob Funk. It would not have happened. He was really dogged about that. And his name should be remembered for that, if for nothing else. Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Now that caused a little controversy.
Of course. We have all kinds of people up here who didn't want a thing changed, but they didn't want anyone telling them what to do with their land. You know, well, you can't. Things are going to change unless there's some restrictions on changing things. I mean, it just comes down to that. That's all there is to it. So, you know, you had the predecessor of property rights people up here from the get-go. And that just meant they were old-timers, and nobody ever told them what they were going to do, and they about start now. They're not going to start now letting somebody tell them what to do. Well, if we don't all agree on this, then anybody can do anything. Well, you just got to make sure you get the right people up here then, boy. And, you know, they did. And they could do that for a while, but then you can't do that forever. Right. That's all there is to it. So, well, you know, Tom Lindbergh was one of those kind of guys. Now, he did wonderful things with his land. Mm-hmm. And since I was on opposite sides with him on every zoning issue and so on, I went up to him one night. It was after a zoning meeting in Kalispell. And I said, "Tom, I want you to know we've had our differences, but I think you did a wonderful claim for the North Fork in putting your land in the Nature Conservancy." And he said, "I didn't do it for people up here. I don't give a good goddamn about anybody up here. I did it for my elk." And that's okay.
That's okay.
It's okay.
He did it for his elk. That's good.
He fed more hay to the elk than he did his cows, because he loved them. And he wanted them to have a place to, you know, come across from the park, which wasn't elk season. And I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't stipulate that whoever owns the place now had to feed the elk, because that's the way he felt about it. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's see. So I've said Frank was a very dear friend, and it blew me away when he blew himself away. I think he's the one up here who created the attitude adjustment hour. He'd show up every other day with a half gallon of gin and say, "How's your attitude? Let's work on it." Ted Ross, I knew everyone who owned the store from the time I was here. And it's gone up, it's gone down, it's on an upswing now.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yes.
I was too late for the Adairs. Ann Henson.
Yes.
You knew her, I think.
I did.
Yeah. You know, I don't remember her husband at all. And I don't think she talked about him. maybe that's why I don't. Who was there? Anyone else on the loop there? The inner loop. I can't remember. There's several houses in there.
So when you started coming up here, it was mostly in the summertime.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you brought your whole family in.
Yes. Yes.
And you fished and hiked.
I guess you know, one of my major reasons for coming to Montana was so I could. So I could spend my summers. I came up '67, '68. Yeah, I came up before I got moved to Montana. In fact, when I was called and asked to be a consultant, I happened to be at the store when the call came through, and it was a Professor Bugby at the University of Montana, and said the Faculty Senate had set up a special committee to look into whether or not the university was acquitting its responsibilities in the academic study of religion, and would I come and advise them. And I said, well, I'm favorably disposed, but I'm really sorry to have to ask this question. Where is the University of Montana? He said, oh, it's in Missoula. And I said, oh, well, I drive through that every year when I come up to my place on the North Fork. So I knew where it was once I found out. Yeah, I was felt a little foolish about that. Well, I see, I thought I'd spend more time here on the North Fork, you know, May to late September, because the university then was on a quarter system. But the truth is, I couldn't spend as much time as when I came from Vanderbilt, because there wasn't a phone up here except the Forest Service phones, and mail was 2 days a week, same as it is now, and you didn't have an internet or anything like that. So at Vanderbilt, they just assumed they couldn't get in touch with me, so they didn't even try. Well, Montana would close up if it was assumed that you couldn't get in touch with anybody, because they were at the cabin, because, you know, everybody's got a cabin. And so people know how to find you. And they did find me. So that part of it, yes, we moved up. And if I had to go away for a few days, why, Fern and the kids would stay here. Yeah, the kids grew up here. Yeah. And then Fern got involved in politics in Missoula and so on. And Fern hasn't come up much since she got involved in government. You know, she was first treasurer, county clerk, and then became commissioner. So for 25 years, she'd come up, you know, on holiday, 4th of July. And of course, it's only recently that I've been able to be up here in the falls.
So when you were up here in the summertime with your family, how was your life different up here than it was back in civilization?
Well, unlike now, the boys and I, of course, I had a garden, and you will not believe this, and I don't believe it either, except that it's true. I gardened up here for 20 years without a fence.
Uh-huh.
Rabbits, gophers, nothing. The only bother I had is when Barbara Lawrence's horses would get out, they wanted to come down and tromp in my garden. That's it. The other thing is, there was very little game here. I never saw a bear when we were in the old cabin. Of course, all this up here where I live now was, we never came up here. A lot of it was underwater because the beavers had diverted the creek back in here. It was just a mass of grass and so on, so we never came up here. We rarely ever saw a deer. The comeback in wildlife in the past 20 years has been amazing, as the decline in fishing has. I mean, the boys and I fished every day, every day. I mean, I usually would try to work at my desk until 3 or 4 in the afternoon, then we'd fish till dark, every evening. And weekends, you always went to the hall. We had a square dance. Business meetings, I don't know why we had business meetings. There really wasn't anything to do. I mean, I was president 1 year, and in those days, the president had I think it was mostly a joke, Mayor of Polebridge.
Oh, really?
Which I have on my CV.
The president was the mayor of Polebridge.
Yes, right. And I have that on my CV, and that's, everybody is so impressed with that in the academic world. You're a professor, and you were mayor of Polebridge, Montana. Now that's something nobody's got. Yeah, you don't want it either. For the kids, I think the most important thing was square dancing. And there were a lot of kids up here then. That's another thing that I've missed. And I'm glad to see some babies up here now. Uh-huh. And some younger kids. Oh, I forgot Paul and what's her name, Moss, up north. And her, their daughter or granddaughter is living up here now. I'm sorry, I can't
Karen McDonough.
Karen McDonough. Yeah, exactly.
That's her daughter.
You know more than I. And what was Paul's wife's name?
Pauline.
Yeah. Of course. See, that always occurs to me, and then I says, that's too obvious. I couldn't be in doubt if it were Pauline, but of course it is. It is. Paul and Pauline. So, square dancing was very important.
Was it every week?
It was very nearly every week. You know, how those old records have survived, I don't know. You know, I mean, they must have been played a million times. The square dances were, before the hall was built, as I said, we'd move around, usually to someone who had a big barn, mm-hmm. or the McFarland Ranch, which had, you know, it was a dude ranch, so they had large areas that would accommodate a number of people. The square dance, the skeet shoots, the midday potluck dinner on the ground parties, occasional fish fries, everyone, except if there was a fishing limit, I don't know what it was. People just bring what they caught that day or the day before, and you'd have a trout fry.
So there was a lot of fish here.
There was a lot of fish.
But not much game.
Not much game. Uh-huh. No. And it, you know, you didn't see hunters out up here in the fall. The people didn't come up from town. I think there just wasn't the game here. Mm-hmm. The same thing has happened, of course, in the eastern part of the United States. I mean, there's so many deer in the east that, you know, they're pests. They're dangerous. Yeah. And Missoula is a remarkable story. Missoula was, well, he had teepee burners all over the place. It smelled like rotten eggs. You couldn't fish in the river. The river ran red. The Clark Fork is now cleaned up. There are deer all over Missoula. We have bears in Missoula eating apples and getting into garbage cans. Bobcats, wild turkeys, and so on. The whole game situation
has changed.
It's just totally changed, and it's all for the better.
Yeah.
It really is.
But really, there were no ground squirrels in your garden?
No. No, I never saw one.
Wow.
No. Where were they? I guess the coyotes were getting them. I think you have to build a garden to so the Colombian ground squirrels have got something to eat. I don't know, but it's, you know, some things change for the better and a lot of things change for the worse. Mm-hmm. I can't remember anyone ever discussing paving the road, ever discussing.
Really?
No, it never came up. The North Fork Improvement Association never came up. No one was for it, so nobody had to be against it. It just didn't occur to anybody. Why would you want the road paved? You just, you know, that was part of the charm of the place. And it keeps the flatlanders out.
So there have been a number of fires up here.
Lordy, yes. I'm not sure I can identify them all. I think the first one I remember was the 67 fire that was worst around Camas Creek. I remember there was a big fuss that went on for 2 weeks between the Park Service and the Forest Service. My recollection is that it started on the Forest Service side. Jumped the river, and the worst part of it was in the park. Mm-hmm. Then it was threatening to come back. And Lloyd was checking in every day with the Park Service and the Forest Service. And he called the Park Service and they say, it started in the Forest Service, called the Park Service, say, it started in the Forest Service, it's their responsibility to put it out. But it's threatening to come back over here. And we get a wind coming out of the south, it's going to come up and burn us up. Well, he'd talk to the Forest Service, and they'd say, well, the park's got to do something about it. After 2 weeks, Lloyd just fired up his D6 Cat and went down and put the bastard out. And this infuriated the park, so they came over with a big bill that he had to go and cover up all of his scar tracks and all that stuff. And he said, if you do that, buddy, I'm going to sue you. And I'm going to I'm going to sue you for not only for legal expenses, but for the hours and equipment expense I spent putting out your goddamn fire. Lord didn't mess with people. So that's what I remember from the 67 fire. And after that, Lordy, I don't know, the Red Bench fire, that was in 88. Mm-hmm. And I was the last one to leave the North Fork, because I didn't know it was happening. I was around there, it was about this time of day, I was around there painting sash on core. We didn't have windows in it, but we had it, you know, plastic over it, and I was painting the sash. And Elliot drove up, came around and said, "What are you doing? You trying to paint this place before it burns down?" I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Have you been around the other side of the building?" Well, he took me around and I could see this wall of smoke back there. He said, "It's down by Red Meadow Creek, and it's coming this way, and everything is closed. The road's closed, Red Meadow's closed, North Fork Road's closed. Your only way out is Trail Creek, and you get your ass out of here." And he said, we're out now. So they turned and left. Well, I got to thinking about that, and I thought, well, no. What about the old cabin down there? So I went down and turned a pump on. I was pumping out of the creek, and I began hosing down the old cabin and so on, because it, you know, had cedar large shingles on it, yeah. Split shakes on it, and so on. So I hosed it all down, and by nightfall, I could see above this hill. I could see 200 feet of flames down there. So I decided I better get out, and I drove up to Trail Creek and out. You know, you come in just south of, is it Eureka or Libby?
Oh.
It's the longest road from there to Kalispell. I got to Kalispell about 2:30 in the morning, having left here about 10, something like that, and was exhausted and rented a motel and went to bed. Didn't call Fern. A damn fool. Meanwhile, Bracken, who always shows up in an emergency, had come to Missoula, and no one had heard from me. So he said, "I'm going to go find him." And he headed north and got to the roadblock and talked his way through the Forest Service people and got up here and didn't find me, and then really got worried. And so then he went back down and helped fight the fire. I mean, he works in the woods all the time anyway. Uh-huh. So he fought in the fire. And finally, after I got to Missoula and got Fern quieting down, we got word up to the Forest Service to find our son and tell him that I was alive, if not well. That's the Red Bench fire. The Wedge Canyon fire, the kids and I were on a horseback trip, backpack trip, into the Bob Marshall. Mm-hmm. Now, the fire had started before we left, but come on, it was 15 miles away, and it was an acre or something like that. So, oh well, we've got a week at least.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, those are the fires. There were other smaller fires, but those three I remember. 67, 88, 2003.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Those are the ones that stick out. Yeah. Of course, I wasn't up here when some of the fires were going, because it was in Missoula.
Well, I think we should put a stop to it right now.
I think we should too.
Okay.